Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, the U.S. economy just going up and up. Stocks, manufacturing, consumer spending. But is all the good news on the up and up, or smoke and mirrors? And kicking the chair out from under the U.S. steel industry. Its protective tariffs seem doomed. But is big steel?
There will always be a substantial steel industry, and I think most of what we need will still be created in the United States for years to come.
And presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich, low in the polls, but still high on his chances.
My presidency will be about realism, the realism of a job, of housing, of health care, of education, of a clean environment, and peace.
These stories and Arab American comedians stand up coming up here and now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Supreme Court has ruled that police waited long enough when they gave a drug suspect 20 seconds warning before smashing down his door. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
In 1998, LaShawn Banks was taking a shower when police announced themselves, waited about 20 seconds, then broke down the door of his Las Vegas apartment. Police found crack cocaine and guns, and Banks served 4 years in prison before his conviction was overturned by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which said police should have waited longer. But the Supreme Court now says that longer notice would have given Banks enough time to dispose of evidence. The court has ruled in the past that police must give some notice before entering. In this ruling, the court declined to give a rule on how much warning is adequate, saying it would depend on individual circumstances. Writing for the majority, Justice David Souter said police had good reason to rush if they suspected drugs were in the apartment. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
The British Foreign Office has warned Britons they should adopt a low profile in Saudi Arabia. The advice follows a similar warning from the U.S. State Department about the threat of more terror attacks there. The U.S. says homes of Westerners who live in Riyadh, the Saudi capital, have been watched by terrorists. Car bombs exploded at three different compounds in Riyadh last May, killing 26 people and an additional 9 bombers. Another attack last month killed 17 people. A trial is underway in Key West, Florida, for 6 Cuban men accused of hijacking a Cuban airliner from Havana to the United States. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
The politically charged trial in federal court is offering two starkly contrasting views of what happened aboard a Cuban DC-3 passenger plane last March 19th. The pilot of the Cuban plane says while en route to the Isle of Youth from Havana, a gang of Cuban men broke through the cockpit door, held a knife against his throat, and demanded the plane be flown to Cuba. The 6 defendants' lawyers say the incident was a freedom flight and that most, if not all of those on board, were collaborating in a plan to leave communist Cuba for the United States. The diversion of the plane caused American forces to scramble 2 fighter jets, which escorted the plane until it landed in Key West. Meanwhile, 14 of the passengers have been allowed to stay in the United States. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
Testimony resumes today in the manslaughter trial of South Dakota Congressman Bill Janklow. He's accused of striking and killing a motorcyclist with his car. Defense attorneys say Janklow suffered a diabetic reaction that caused him to speed through a stop sign. Possible prosecution witnesses could include Senate Minority Leader and South Dakota Senator Tom Daschle. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 16 points at 98.82. The Nasdaq is up 3 points at 19.92. The S&P 500 is up a fraction at 1,070. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, a study by a job placement firm finds the number of company layoffs dropped dramatically in November. The firm Challenger Gray and Christmas reports there were less than 100,000 planned layoffs last month. That compares to October's report, when companies said they plan to cut nearly 172,000 jobs. Soft drink and snack food giant PepsiCo has announced it will cut some 750 jobs as it moves to reduce costs. Carrie Nolan of member station WNYC in New York has more.
PepsiCo says it will close a Frito-Lay plant in Louisville, Kentucky, and shut down some other manufacturing lines, affecting 330 employees. The company did not detail the rest of the job cuts, but said most would be in North America. The reorganization comes about 18 months after PepsiCo consolidated its North American drinks business into one unit. Under the new plan, the company will separate the business into three units: Pepsi-Cola, Gatorade, and Tropicana juice products. The company is doing the opposite for its international operations, bringing together its overseas drinks and snack business. The announcement came shortly before the company was scheduled to hold a meeting with investors. PepsiCo, which is the world's second largest soft drink maker, employs 142,000 people worldwide. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Nolan.
The parent company of FAO Schwartz Toy Store is going back into bankruptcy. FAO Incorporated just got out of bankruptcy protection 8 months ago. Company officials say now they want to sell off FAO Schwartz and the Right Start operations. Company officials plan to liquidate the Zany Brainy business. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop offers compilations of music featured on NPR programming, including the new I Heard It on NPR box set at npr.org.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. The U.S. economy just keeps firing off new salvos of good news. Manufacturing's at its highest level in two decades. The stock market soared to its highest level in 18 months yesterday. And over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, retail figures showed wallets opening with seemingly gleeful abandon from one end of the country to the other. But are Americans living on borrowed time economically? What about next year's $500 billion federal deficit? Well, for a look at the ups and possible downs of this economic recovery, we're joined now by Mark Zandi, chief economist for economy.com. And Mark, do these numbers mirror an economy that's roaring back to long-term health, or is this smoke and mirrors, a short-term good run caused by the stimulus of especially 3 years of huge tax cuts?
This is for real. Obviously, the tax cuts have helped. Low interest rates have helped even more. But I do think with the resumption of job growth that this is real and we can look forward to better economic times ahead.
This morning, stocks are slipping just a little bit as people are taking advantage, I guess, of yesterday's gains. Now, I understand December is historically the strongest month for stocks. Does that What's driving this?
No, I do think the stock market is strong because the economy is improving, and the prospects are that economic growth will be good into 2004 and into 2005. The fundamentals of the economy have improved, and I think most importantly, confidence is back. We're all beginning to believe, particularly business people, that if they do go out and expand and invest and hire, that the things that they will be producing will be purchased. And I think that's the most important thing that's changed over the last few weeks, couple months. And I think that's reflected in stock prices.
So much of it can be psychological, can't it, whether it's a boom or a bust. 2.5 million manufacturing jobs lost in recent years. Are those jobs coming back? The Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that the self-employed are helping boost the economy. How does that all play together?
Those manufacturing jobs aren't coming back. Mm. There are still many people, many parts of the country that are still struggling. The most obvious is in manufacturing and those communities that depend on manufacturing. And although the manufacturing parts of our economy are beginning to see better conditions, it's still going to be tough times. They still have to compete globally, and that's going to be difficult. And even in the best of times, I think we'll see very little job growth in manufacturing. It's just largely a question of how many jobs will we be losing.
Well, as with this question of the self-employed helping boost the economy, maybe what you're saying is that we're seeing a new economy emerging.
We are. Out of the ashes of some of these very depressed sectors of our economy, we are starting to see some entrepreneurial activity.
Mm-hmm.
Smaller businesses, even individuals that have lost their jobs at bigger companies have set up shop and are now striking out on their own and trying to make a go of it, and it's reaping some benefit.
Mark, I hate to be a Scrooge, but that $500 billion deficit next year, I've asked it before, I'll ask it again. It's sometimes hard to tease out the answer. Does it matter or not that we owe that much money?
Well, Bill, you'd make a good economist. Always worried about something, are you not?
Right.
Yeah, there are things to be worried about, and that certainly is one of the key things to worry about. I mean, one of the reasons we are where we are today is because we had tremendous tax cuts and tremendous government spending, and the result of that is a very large looming budget deficit, so that prospects are that they'll just remain large for the foreseeable future. And there's a dark side to all of that, and I'm afraid we're going to see that in the down the road, and it's something we're going to have to address. For the moment, I think, though, it's after three very lean years, it feels awfully good to be talking positively. But you're right, there are some problems still left to work through, and that's one of the key ones.
Naturally enough. Well, Mark Zandi, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Mark Zandi is chief economist for Economy.com. And now, steel tariffs. President Bush is in the heart of steel country today in Pittsburgh at a fundraising event co-hosted by U.S. Steel Chairman and CEO Thomas Usher. What's striking about where the president's touching down, of course, is that the administration is reportedly close to lifting tariffs on imported steel, a move some say could threaten the very existence of the U.S. steel industry. Well, I'm joined now by Neil King, Jr. of The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Neil.
Hello.
Neil, just briefly, what is the latest on how likely it is those protective tariffs on imported steel will be abandoned?
Highly likely. There's really no better alternative that the president faces at the moment. Not lifting them would cause him much more harm and much more of a headache than keeping them in place.
And that is, of course, because of those sanctions threatened by the European Union that could have cost American traders $2 billion a year. What do you think, Neil, U.S. Steel Chairman Thomas Usher will have on his mind when he sits down with the president? Will he be contemplating the end of the U.S. steel industry as we know it?
I think that would be a bit much to say that that's what really the eventuality here is. I mean, the reality is that these tariffs have applied to a fairly limited amount of incoming steel, about 25% of the steel that comes into the U.S. And there are a whole variety of factors, at least at the moment, that make things fairly good for the domestic industry. The dollar has fallen by about 20% against the euro and a variety of other currencies. Steel is a lot more expensive overseas now. Therefore, a lot of steel is heading into other markets. And China is the huge emerging user of steel, and much steel is also headed in that direction. So at least for some months to come, everyone says, and probably even longer, that the U.S. steel industry is going to have a bit of a reprieve, even if these tariffs go by the wayside.
Neil, how many people are employed in the U.S. steel industry, and how many could, despite the fact that it's not a completely black scenario, how many could lose their jobs?
You know, for the steel industry, for all of the noise that it makes and the attention that it gets, both politically and otherwise, is an extraordinarily small industry. It's like 150,000 employees, something like that. Much larger number of retirees, which also make a lot of noise, and that is one of the big problems because their retirement benefits are constantly in jeopardy. But if you look at something like I was talking with someone yesterday, talking about 7 million people in the United States are employed by European subsidiaries doing various things in the United States. That's a number that's, you know, vastly outnumbers the number of people in the U.S. steel industry. Steel all over the world seems to get a strangely emotional response and an undue amount of attention because it kind of goes back to the roots of the industrial era, and everyone thinks it to be kind of the core essential commodity, though things have changed in so many ways that that's not really the case.
Is it self-evident that the decision to slap these tariffs on in the first place was a flop, a mistake?
I think the administration can fairly effectively argue that it did give the industry a reprieve 20 months or so, and that there have been changes within the industry that have helped it out. There's been a lot of consolidations, steel companies buying up other steel companies, the kind of efficiencies that were being sought here. So it's certainly not completely out of the woods, but there is a fair portion of the steel industry, the so-called mini mills that make steel from other steel, essentially, and not steel from raw materials, that is actually in quite good shape. There's a lot of the steel industry that's actually in very good shape. It's just the portions of it that are by and large, the kind of old line makers that are the most in trouble at the moment.
Neil, just briefly, and to finish up, what's the future of the U.S. steel industry?
I to predict that there would one day not be a steel industry is definitely not going to be the case. I mean, we consume too much steel, and as a matter of fact, we use about, we only import about 15% of what we actually consume. I think it's going to consolidate further and perhaps go more towards these kind of mini-mill operations where the raw steel will be brought in from other countries that can make it more cheaply. But there will always be a substantial steel industry, and I think most of what we need will still be created in the United States for years to come.
Neil King Jr. is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Neil, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Well, U.S. military officials in Iraq are denying what Iraqi politicians are telling reporters, that U.S. forces have captured or killed the most senior Iraqi official after Saddam Hussein himself in the former Ba'athist regime. The U.S. has offered a $10 million reward for the capture of Esad Ibrahim al-Douri. He's thought to be a key coordinator of insurgents attacking U.S. forces in Iraq. The killing or capture of al-Douri was supposed to have taken place during a large military operation in Kirkuk. That sort of big, hard-hitting military operation is the new strategy for U.S. forces in Iraq. An assault in the town of Samarra on Sunday is still raising questions. Anthony Shadid of The Washington Post has just been in Samarra. He joins us now from Baghdad. And thanks for joining us, Anthony.
Thank you.
Anthony, what's your best sense now of that grim calculation? How many Iraqi fighters died in this big combat with the Americans, and how many Iraqi civilians?
Well, the U.S. military has provided different numbers, even on the same day. They first said it was 46 Iraqi fighters who were killed, then raised that number to 54. Now, the military says that the number was arrived at through interviews with soldiers after they returned from the clash in the town of Samarra. They believe that each of those deaths was confirmed by more than one person, and they feel pretty confident about that figure. It's very odd that when you travel into Samarra, though, hardly anyone can attest to that, having seen bodies of fighters in the streets or even having seen fighters being killed. And, of course, a lot of people were inside their homes during the clashes. The hospital there says they only know of 8 people killed, 7 that they can provide identities of, and 1 other person that they heard about being killed. All 8 of those people are civilians, including an elderly Iranian pilgrim, a woman, and 2 males that they said were under 18 years old.
So, Anthony, did you meet anyone in Samarra who acknowledged that a large number, or indeed any, fighters had been killed?
Well, there's no question that a very large clash went on, and it dragged on through much of the day. Like I said, most of the people were inside. Even before the clash started, soldiers were counted seeing people run down the streets trying to look for cover, and that happened even before the shooting started. So there was clearly people knew what was about to happen. By all accounts, it was bloody. It's just the question of where the bodies is, and that remains unanswered.
Were they fedayeen in black uniforms, as was reported early, some of these allegedly killed fighters, or has the military even pulled back on that?
Well, terminology is a really contested issue in Iraq, and the U.S. military will call these people fedayeen, which has a very clear connotation to followers of Saddam Hussein. When you go into the village itself, into the city of Samarra, people refer to them as Mujahideen, which has a much more religious connotation, the sense of a holy fighter, and people refer to these people as being Mujahideen. The descriptions of the fighters, people in the city who did see them running through the streets, does match up. The U.S. military said that they were wearing checkered headscarves, which is often associated with these guerrillas, dark pants and dark shirts. One person I spoke to in the hospital there did say he saw dozens of these fighters running around during the battle. He was the only person that I spoke to who actually admitted to seeing these people. And he did describe them that way, that they were wearing these headscarves checkered in red or black, and he did refer to them as Mujahideen.
The United States and many other countries now have lost so many to these fighters. And yet you quote soldiers who went into Samarra over the weekend expressing a kind of almost grudging respect for some of the people that were shooting at them.
Well, you did hear a different story from soldiers this time. And I think when people look back on what happened in Samarra a couple of days ago, probably what's going to be most memorable other than the body count is that it was the first time that guerrillas have massed in significant numbers and tried to go toe-to-toe with the U.S. military. They It's a question if they knew they were going to face the firepower they did, but there's no question that the toll inflicted was because the Americans brought a tremendous amount of firepower to the battle. And one soldier I did talk to was saying that. He said he was having trouble kind of putting it together in his head how these people knew that they were going to die, and they still pulled the trigger knowing that it was going to be their last shot. There was a maybe, I don't know if you call it respect, but kind of maybe an amazement at what he at least considered a suicide mission.
Anthony Shadid of The Washington Post joined us from Baghdad. Anthony, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Just ahead, we meet Denis Kucinich, who says, despite the polls, he's going to be elected president. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Today, in the second of our conversations with the Democratic presidential candidates, we turn to former Cleveland mayor and four-term Ohio congressman Denis Kucinich. Congressman Kucinich joins us from the studios of public radio station WCPN in Cleveland. Welcome, Congressman.
Hi.
Congressman, thanks for making some time. Let's start with an issue that's as prominent as any at the moment, Iraq. You've called for the troops to be home by New Year's, but Congressman, both polls and reporting from Iraq itself indicate millions of Iraqis fear even greater chaos if U.S. troops leave. Don't we have a responsibility, having invaded and occupied that country, to now try to rebuild it?
Well, I think it's important to establish the context of the plan, which I offered over a month ago and put on my website at kucinich.us. That plan calls for the United States to go to the UN with a totally new approach. And that new approach would enable the United Nations to commit sufficient peacekeeping troops who would rotate in while the U.S. troops come home. Now, the features of the plan are as follows. We'd have to change direction, and that direction would mean, number one, the U.S. would give up all ambitions to control the oil of Iraq, let the UN handle on an interim basis the disposition of the oil assets of Iraq for the Iraqi people, turn over to the UN the handling of all contracting to be made on behalf of the Iraqi people, and to make sure that the people in Iraq are served by the UN in the UN developing a new cause of governance.
Congressman, what difference would it make if the UN went in there? How would it change the security situation? The people that are shooting at American soldiers blew up the UN compound there and killed dozens of people.
Well, surely you must understand that the presence of the United States in Iraq is a destabilizing factor. And in fact, if we continue to remain in Iraq, the troop losses are only going to mount. The cost to the American taxpayers will continue to be extreme beyond the $130 billion, and that we have no resolution in sight.
Congressman, you support the creation of a cabinet-level Department of Peace, which would emphasize non-aggressive approaches to domestic and foreign policy. What impact would a Department of Peace have on terrorism?
Certainly the United States' presence in Iraq did nothing to quell terrorism and has probably done much to inspire it by creating a recruiting poster for al-Qaeda through our presence in Iraq. So that was the wrong way. But through international cooperation in the cause of rooting out terrorism and tracking people down who are involved in trying to inspire violence against individuals or mass publics, that's what we can do that can take a step towards making this country safer and the world safer. The Department of Peace would work with the administration as a cabinet-level position. in providing a range of options for a president as to how we might be able to meet the challenge of terrorism without engaging in war.
Congressman, let's shift to a critical domestic issue, the health care system. You've said you want a single-payer system, but that's an approach that's so radically different from the reality of what Congress is talking about, like it or not. Is that tilting at windmills?
Tilting at windmills is when a family finds they can't afford health care anymore because the premiums have gone up, or they can't afford the copays and the deductibles. And when they get a bill after someone's sick, they find out that they have to either mortgage their house or go bankrupt. I mean, let's talk about the realities of health care. Health care in this country is controlled by the insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. And my plan is to take health care for profit and end that system and create a not-for-profit system where everyone's covered. We're already paying for a universal standard of care. We're not getting it because our health care dollar goes to corporate profits, stock options, high executive salaries, lobbying, advertising, marketing. I want the money to all go into health care.
Congressman, it's a splendid idea. I think one of the raps against you is that you're too much of an idealist in a very hardcore world to work with a very hardcore Congress and get things done.
Now, let me say that I'm a realist, and I think it's realistic to ask for a full employment economy where everyone has a chance for a good paying job. I think it's realistic to insist that America be able to provide tuition-free college education for our young people. I'll tell you what's unrealistic. What's unrealistic is tax cuts that go to the people in the top brackets. It's unrealistic to have a fear-driven Pentagon budget over $400 billion now a year, more than all the other nations of the world. That's unrealistic. So my presidency will be about realism, the realism of a job, of housing, of health care, of education, of a clean environment, and peace.
Just to address an issue that's very much in your neck of the woods, the steel tariffs. The president appears to be about to repeal them. Your position on that?
It would be a misfortune for American workers if the president would rescind those tariffs. You know, we lost over 35 steel mills in this country, many of them due to unfair competition. You have to remember that we're producing steel that's consumed in this market. If we get stuck buying steel from other markets, we're actually losing the opportunity to employ our own people. And I also object to the United States knuckling under to the World Trade Organization. The World Trade Organization cares not about workers' wages, about workers' rights, human rights, environmental quality principles. And this is precisely the reason why I've said that as the next president of the United States, my first act in office will be to withdraw from NAFTA and the WTO and return to bilateral trade, which is conditioned on workers' rights, human rights, and environmental quality principles.
Congressman, with all due respect, is it realistic to think that you're going to be the Democratic candidate? Your poll numbers have not gone beyond single figures. How do you win this nomination, and then how do you win this presidency?
Let me say that it must be very painful for people in the media to do all of their analysis based on polls and not do any analysis based on the practical aspirations of the people of this country. And as people learn about my policies and what my platform is, I have no doubt that my standing in those polls will begin to rise, because people want someone who will stand against this occupation and bring our troops home. People want someone who wants jobs for all, who wants health care for all, who wants education for all. People want my candidacy. It's just that they don't know about it yet, and as they know about it, they're going to find that's exactly what they've been looking for.
We've been speaking with Congressman Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, who's running for president as a Democrat. Congressman, we want to thank you so much for joining us on Here and Now.
This is a great interview. Thanks.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Coming up, researchers are ready to test an electrode that could help disabled people move.
You know, for people who are basically trapped in their bodies, give them some freedom.
And Arab-American comedians, nothing's off-limits in a New York comedy club.
So I come from a big Egyptian-American family, and I think the best thing about being Egyptian is that I have this ambiguous face where the average racist doesn't know which racial slur to call me. Why you? You nit, you hint, you spit. I hate you.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. Police in England have arrested more than a dozen people under the British Terrorism Act. Charles de Ledesma reports.
The raids, which took place mostly in London, Cambridge and the West Midlands, have led to more than a dozen people being arrested on suspicion of terrorism offences. In London, men between the ages of 28 and 32 were detained by anti-terrorist officers, who raided six homes and three business addresses. And in Cambridge, two women were among the arrests at two different addresses. On Monday, police were granted 48 more hours to hold one suspect, Sajid Badat, who was arrested in Gloucester last week. He's believed to have connections with Al-Qaeda. Senior policeman John Stevens says the arrests are part of an ongoing operation. Charles de Ledesma, London.
Renewed warnings today about a threat of more terrorist attacks in Saudi Arabia. The British Foreign Office has warned its citizens living in Saudi Arabia to, quote, adopt a low profile. Recently, the United States warned that Westerners' homes near Riyadh had been under active surveillance by terrorists. Iraqis are complaining about long lines at their gas stations, as well as widespread gasoline shortages. The oil ministry is blaming the crunch on 250,000 new cars that have flooded into the country since import regulations were lifted. Iraq is planning to build two new refineries to increase the output of oil products. Its three main refineries are operating below capacity, partly due to pipeline sabotage. A Bosnian Serb intelligence officer who pleaded guilty to killing more than 7,000 Muslim boys and men in a 1995 massacre was sentenced today to 27 years in prison for his war crimes. Also in The Hague today, two of the highest-ranking Muslims to be charged with war crimes in the Bosnian conflict will go on trial. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled police need only wait 20 seconds before busting into a drug suspect's home. The ruling is based on a Las Vegas case in which the justices said had police waited longer, the suspect would have had enough time to flush evidence down the toilet. President Bush has signed legislation designed to help kids in foster care get adopted. The Adoption Promotion Act builds on a Clinton-era program, creating incentives to adoption efforts. Nationwide, 126,000 children are in foster care, waiting for a permanent home. On Wall Street today, stocks are mixed. The Dow is down 19 points at 9880. The NASDAQ is up 2 points at 1993. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. For tens of thousands of quadriplegics in the United States, the simplest gestures are out of reach, to just wave to a friend or play a video game. But there's new hope because of an approach to helping the paralyzed that seems, at first glance, straight from science fiction. The idea is to implant electrodes in the brain. WBUR reporter Alan Cockle joins us now on the line. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Bill.
Well, Alan, electrodes in the brain to help the paralyzed. Who's doing the work on this?
Well, there are a number of groups looking at this approach. One in particular that is now applying to use it in human patients is based in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. That's John Donahue at Brown University in connection with the Massachusetts Foxborough company called CyberKinetics Corporation. And the way it works is when you have quadriplegia or neurodegenerative diseases that leave you unable to move your limbs, there's nothing usually wrong with the brain. The region of the brain that controls the hands is still fine. So if you could put an electrode in there and take that signal out, send it to a computer, make sense of it, then you could perhaps give somebody control over one of those devices. I met John Donahue at his lab at Brown University in Providence, and he showed me where they worked with monkeys who were playing video games.
When we do what's called neural cursor control, then the activity goes directly from the brain into the processors in the next room, and then that cursor is then controlled directly by the brain output, and the monkey can play the video game and does play the video game directly from the brain.
So what it boils down to, Alan, is that in a quadriplegic person or in a monkey, the cells in the brain just need to be stimulated to do what they're supposed to do, to send a message down the line.
Well, in fact, it's not stimulation. These are electrodes not to send an electrical impulse into the brain, but just a passive receiver in near those brain cells to pick up the signals and take it out.
Uh-huh.
And so the way it worked with the monkeys is the monkeys sat in a chair and played a video game using a joystick. They chased a target around the screen. When they caught up with the target, they got a little juice reward, which they like. And at a certain point, they disconnected the joystick. The monkeys didn't know that, of course, and just monitored that brain activity that they'd been monitoring all along and found that using computers, they could take the monkey's intent, not the actual joystick movement, but the intent, and those monkeys, just using their brains, were able to move the cursor around the screen and capture that target.
Wow. Can it be done with human beings?
Well, that is the big question, and CyberKinetics Corporation is going to ask this month the FDA for permission to try this procedure in the first 5 human patients, people with quadriplegia probably. And the big question is, will they be able to initially move a cursor around a screen, perhaps surf the Internet, which if you hadn't been able to do that, if you had no control over your limbs, would be a pretty big breakthrough.
How soon could this happen?
Well, if they get permission, they'll begin with the first patient sometime early next year or mid next year.
And there are applications beyond dealing with quadriplegics?
There are. I spoke with Tim Sergenor. He's the president and CEO of CyberKinetics, the corporation we talked about. And he said, initially we're looking at patients with quadriplegia because that's sort of the best way to prove that this technology can work. But down the line, he sees all kinds of other potential applications.
The best proof of concept of that is to help people who are disabled. It's not the only application, and it may not be the biggest application, but it is the first application. So that's what we're focused on today. We have a small effort underway to start looking at the idea of interpreting signals that are part of disease. So, for example, in epilepsy, there are probably signals in the brain that have to do with when you might have a seizure. Also in depression or obsessive compulsive disorder or other diseases. But we're not very far in that. But that's another big application, probably bigger application from a marketing point of view.
Tim Sergenor of CyberKinetics. Alan, this must mean so much to so many of the disabled to hear about this sort of thing. Have you spoken to any of the disabled? How are they feeling about it? Are they hopeful or skeptical?
I think both, Bill, and with good reason. A lot of stories come along that promise a lot, and someone I talked to said, you know, they don't all deliver, and they're very aware of that. On the other hand, the potential here is so huge to capture to that region of the brain that gives us such fine control over our fingers and limbs. And you know, when one person I talked to was Paul Gentile, who's a guy who just has a little bit of movement in one hand right now, and he thought about, you know, what kind of control could this give me over my environment?
My body's, you know, gone through some major changes, and I'll never be totally able-bodied, but I believe that, you know, down the road, who knows? The sky's the limit with what, you know, I might be able to attain, at least be able to transfer in and out of bed or into a vehicle on my own. Or, you know, for people who are basically trapped in their bodies, you give them some freedom, true freedom. You know?
Wow. Paul Gentile, dreaming of the possibility of greater freedom than anyone could have ever imagined for quadriplegics like himself. Alan Cockle, thanks so much for joining us on this.
Pleasure, Bill.
WBUR's Alan Cockle. And now this note. Researchers in Wisconsin say they've developed a procedure that may simplify screening for colon cancer. The process is called virtual colonoscopy, and it appears to be as effective as conventional procedures in detecting polyps. In standard colonoscopies, tube-like cameras move through several feet of a patient's bowels. The patient is sedated for the procedure, and there's a risk of inadvertently puncturing the intestines. Well, virtual colonoscopy uses a CT scanner, which takes three-dimensional images of the intestines. No sedation is necessary. If polyps are detected, though, a conventional colonoscopy may be needed. The virtual tests are not yet widely available. One of the researchers, Dr. Perry Pickard of the University of Wisconsin, says there's evidence that virtual colonoscopies are effective. Coverage by insurance companies, Pickard says, should be the next step. As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. You can send us mail the old-fashioned way, too. Mail your letters to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts 02215. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, Arab American comics looking for laughs, and they find plenty at an Arab American comedy festival in New York City. You're listening to Here and Now. The day before he died, former priest and convicted child abuser John Gagan played a game of cards with some fellow inmates at the Sousa Baranowski Correctional Center in central Massachusetts. Gagan was a recent arrival at the prison, though he was probably its most notorious prisoner. Accusations that he'd molested more than 100 minors had ignited turmoil in the Catholic Church and brought down Boston's powerful archbishop. Gagan had recently been transferred to Sousa Baranowski after he complained that guards at another prison harassed and mistreated him. In May, Gagan wrote to a legal advisor saying he felt safer in his new state-of-the-art maximum security prison. He said it was better run than where he'd been before. But by late August, John Gagan was dead, murdered by a fellow inmate. In a three-part series in the Boston Globe, Thomas Farragher writes about the last days of John Gagan. Thomas Farragher now joins us. And hi, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
Tom, Joseph Druce killed John Gagan. Druce was an avowed hater of child abusers, yet he was placed in the same unit with an infamous child abuser. How did that happen?
That's the question, and there are some moves in Massachusetts. The reverberations of decisions like these are being felt. The Commissioner of Corrections is out as of this morning, and perhaps there'll be more moves like that. We'll have to wait and see.
That's right, Tom. Michael Maloney had taken a medical leave, but we have now learned he will not be returning to his job. Tom, what kind of prisoner was John Gagan?
there was sort of a, you know, a passive aggressiveness about him. He could, on the one hand, be complaining about sort of minor infractions done to him, and on the other hand, be very timid, be very obsequious. And then even in the psychiatric reports that were done when the church sent Gagin to a series of psychiatrists over many years, one of the things they pointed out repeatedly, and I think you could make a case that it was true of Gagin, the prisoner, was this was a guy who was not only a very damaged sort of psychologically, but very immature. I mean, there was I remember reading a report from the very earliest days of John Gagin's seminary life where the rector sent a note to his home saying, John has this marked immaturity, and they wondered whether he should even proceed in the priesthood.
Had he been treated badly by other prisoners in the new prison? Were there warning flags raised at the new prison as there had been at the old?
Interestingly enough, no. His lawyer said even in Concord, the inmates sort of had a live-and-let-live code, and that was certainly true at Sousa Baranowski until Joseph Druce arrived on the scene. And in the final days, inmates were telling us that Druce took some delight in taunting Gagin, saying things like, I'm glad I wasn't an altar boy, and why don't you do everybody a favor and you know, kill yourself, things like that. So that was the sign at Shirley that there was trouble on that cell block.
Yeah, at Shirley, where the prison is in Massachusetts. Tom, what's it like to write about a man accused and convicted of such evil as a victim?
That is precisely sort of the delicate journalistic terrain that we were treading here, which is to write about Gagin, who is, by all accounts, a monster. Mm. And on the other hand, to write about him in a way that he was not sort of this caricature, this one-dimensional pedophile monster, but to write about the fact that he had relatives who loved him, who were worried about his treatment in prison, and then to write about the state's responsibility for even somebody like Gagin, even somebody who is accused or convicted of the most monstrous acts. What is the state's responsibility to keep somebody like him safe?
Thomas Farragher, author of a three-part series in the Boston Globe about John Gagin's last days. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Bill.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. A group of young comics recently staged the first ever Arab-American comedy festival in New York City, a three-day event celebrating the yucks of Arab-American contributions to theater, film, and stand-up.
Welcome, welcome! The first annual New York Arab-American comedy festival. Are you psyched or what? Carrie Louise, I'm your host, and I'm Italian, and I'm actually Lebanese, people think I'm Italian, I'm Lebanese.
An overcapacity crowd of 200-plus gathered at an Upper West Side comedy club for the stand-up night of the festival. Producer Karen Pellin was there.
The evening featured the usual fodder for stand-up, politics, virginity, airport security, but from a decidedly different perspective. Festival co-creator, law student-turned-comic, Dean Obidala.
You know what it's like right now, living in New York, with the last thing that has the word Allah in it? Let's all give a big group hug to each other right now, folks. A friend of mine tried to help me, because, Dean, why don't you change your name from Obidala, which is an Arabic word, to the real English translation, and maybe no one will notice the Middle Eastern heritage. Of course, this is my name translated to English. It translates into servant of Allah. Not going to help me that much. how difficult would it be for me to make airline flight reservations for the rest of my entire life? Call American Airlines. Hi, 2 tickets. Miami, please. Name? Oh, Mr. Servant of Allah. Okay, hang on. Let me transfer to somebody who can help you. Hello, FBI.
It was after 9/11 when the American community came together. They felt like they were on the seas. They were circling the wagons. And we realized there's so much talent out there, not just comics, but we saw actors coming up and things. So we did this festival to showcase all of them, the playwrights, the actors. And I think that's important for us, the Arab American comics, to talk about being Arab American on stage, because we're hoping that helps humanize us as a group and does build some goodwill.
Did the audience tonight make you feel any more comfortable, or was it just like any other audience?
Oh, no, it's completely different audiences. I do probably 10 or 12 shows a week. There's probably 2 or 3 Arab Americans in the audience of any of those shows. This was 99% or 98% Arab American. Every reference, and it makes us happy, they laugh at every reference because it's truthful. It rings true to them. They know the feeling of being suspicious in your own country, feeling uncomfortable in your own land, having a diverse background. A lot of them have mixed marriages. Like in my case, my mom being Catholic and Italian, my father being Palestinian and Muslim.
I grew up in northern Jersey, in Lodi, New Jersey. I'm from Lodi. Let me tell you the ethnic diversity of Lodi, New Jersey when I was growing up. You were either Italian or you were my dad. And my dad has an accent. He's born in Palestine. And the Jersey kids in northern Jersey, they have an accent too. So it's like a battle of the accents growing up. Like, the Jersey kids come over and see my dad. They're like, hey, Mr. Bidala, what's going on? How you doing? What's going on? My dad's just like, I don't know. What is going on? And the Jersey kids are like, your dad has such a freaking weird accent. Where is he from? I'm like, well, he was born in Palestine. And they're like, oh, southern Jersey? I'm like, no, the Middle East. They're like, oh, like Ohio? Again, just like Ohio.
The festival's other creator was actress and comedian Maysoon Zayed.
Hi, guys. I'm Maysoon Zayed. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself. I am a Palestinian Muslim virgin with cerebral palsy from New Jersey, who was engaged to a Canadian Irish river dancing faggot, and just came out of a relationship with a 40-year-old Palestinian Christian tambourine player. Now, there's a reason I dated a river dancer and a tambourine player, because if you don't date gay men, you don't stay a virgin.
Maysoon was about to leave on a trip to the West Bank, where she runs an arts program for Palestinian refugee children. While there, she doesn't let her comedy get rusty.
I do comedy over there. I've done shows in Bethlehem, Jerusalem. I had a show booked in Gaza, but it was canceled due to an invasion. And this year I booked December 5th in Nazareth and December 6th in Haifa. My Arabic act is a lot more about family stuff. I still do tons of politics. I make fun of both Arafat and Sharon, and I make fun of Bush, of course. But I do nearly nothing on dating and stuff. I talk more about marriage rather than dating, because that's not really about there, you know.
It's pretty simple why I want to get married. I'm not quite convinced anymore that I actually have cerebral palsy. I think I'm just frustrated.
Actor and comic Nasri Malak was born in Cairo, Egypt, grew up in New Jersey, and lives in Manhattan.
So I come from a big Egyptian-American family, and I think the best thing about being Egyptian is that I have this ambiguous face where the average racist doesn't know which racial slur to call me. Why you Nick, you hit me, spit. I hate you. You can freaking other.
Well, I knew it was like shooting fish in a barrel. I could have said anything and they were going to appreciate it. So it was a lot of the material that they really, really liked is the ethnic stuff as opposed to like all my other stuff. You know, I'd say 30% of my act is ethnic, and the other 70s, you know, about being a New Yorker and having a relationship and all this other stuff. So, and I know they didn't want to hear that. They came here for the ethnic stuff. So, you know, you got to give the audience what they want. So that's what I gave them. That wasn't the case before September 11th. We never had shows like this. We never organized. We never got together. It's a shame something that tragic had to happen for us to do that.
I actually get nervous when people call me by my correct slur. Are you camel jockey? Wait a minute. Who told you that? That's supposed to be a secret. Shh.
What did the audience think? Rhonda Jamal is a Palestinian-American living in New York.
I think it was really humorous, and in a way also it eases the suffering of Arab Americans, because it's like making fun of our own misery, you know, in terms of all the things we have to go through now in this country and how we're portrayed.
What's up, New York? Welcome to the Access of Evil tour. For those of you that don't know who I am, my name really is Ahmed Ahmed, and I can't fly anywhere. Security's gotten so bad, now I just show up to the airport in a G-string. I'm like, yeah, yeah, sure.
Egyptian-born and California-raised Ahmed Ahmed was the most recognizable of the comics. He even had a role in the big-screen action blockbuster Executive Decision. He played Terrorist Number 4.
I'm so happy to have all these Arabs in here, man. Makes me feel proud. It also makes me scared. Because the FBI is outside taking a good look at everybody. It's a bad time to be from the Middle East because, you know, I read a statistic that said hate crimes against Arabs and Muslims went up over 1,000% right after 9/11, which still put us in fourth place behind blacks, gays, and Jews. It's true. So what do we have to do?
Among the sea of Arabs in the audience was Frank Isdell, an Irishman.
I thought it was kind of funny, but upsetting at the same time in some way.
Why did you find it upsetting?
Because obviously a lot of the jokes were trying to make fun of something which is very serious, and that's the repression that these people feel living in the country.
Perhaps the evening was best summed up by Frank's boyfriend, Mark Sharifi, an Iraqi immigrant.
It was good to laugh. You know, living with it every day, it's just good to laugh about it. And you don't think about the sadness, that you come here to escape the sadness. But I think it's just a relief to hear someone else talk about it.
The stand-up night of the festival was hosted by the comedy club Stand Up New York. The club's owner is a Jewish American who has worked with festival organizer Dean Obidala in the past, bringing Arab and Jewish comics together for joint performances. And with the success of the inaugural Arab American Comedy Festival, Dean has nothing but optimism for the future.
I mean, next year we hope we could do maybe 4 or 5 nights of a festival instead of 3, and people will come. Arab Americans from around the country will start coming in. And we're hoping the festival inspires other fellow Arab Americans to start writing comedy and getting involved in entertainment. It's so important.
I think if George Bush has taught us anything, he's taught us that no matter how bad the original is, the sequel's going to suck even more.
Our visit to the first annual New York Arab American Comedy Festival was produced by Karen Pellin. For more comedy from the Arab American comedians, go to our website at here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney. Get into your radio and join us again here and now. وانا مهما حاولتي انسى بياخدني الشوق اليكي ايه اليكي
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. Join me next time for the news and these stories here and now. Richard Gebhardt in another run for the White House. We'll talk with the candidate for president about why he thinks it'll work this time. And we'll review a few books about cooking that border on literature. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.